The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com.
The Last Walk from Ravensdale Woods by Alexander Colfer. The leprechaun clawed its way through the hardened earth, each movement agony as radiation-poisoned soil crumbled about him. The mound in Ravensdale Woods, once his sacred dwelling, had collapsed inward, the ancient magic barely sustaining its structure. He emerged into a world transformed, gasping as unfamiliar air filled lungs that had not breathed for 15 years. What remained of the woods stretched before him like a blackened skeleton. Trees stood as charred sentinels, their branches reaching skyward in permanent supplication. The protective canopy that had sheltered his kind for millennia was gone, leaving him exposed to a sickly yellow sky. He stood 7 feet tall, but stooped now with weakness. His skin, once the rich texture of oak bark, had faded to sickly ashen gray. The eyes that had terrified young Helen Colfer over a century ago were dulled, the bog water green now murky and clouded. He pulled his once moss-green coat about him, which had become brown and threadbare, as if to ward off the cold. "The land dies, and so do I," he whispered, his voice a dry, whispery rasp where once it had rumbled like distant thunder. As he steadied himself against a blackened tree stump, he felt the stirring within. Deep within his essence he felt them, his children that he had absorbed after the bombs fell. Their voices, once a chorus of wild music in his mind, had diminished to faint whispers. They had been his last connection to the old world, these half-human offspring born of Helen and others who had broken promises over the centuries. When the radiation had poisoned the earth, he had drawn them back into himself, consuming their essence to survive the long winter. A terrible choice, but necessary. Better to preserve some fragment of the AOC than to let their magic dissipate into nothing. "Forgive me," he murmured to their fading presence. "Your sacrifice will not be wasted." He turned toward what had once been Enniscorthy, driven by an instinct older than memory. If any humans had survived, they would need water and shelter. They would rebuild near the river as they always had. The journey that once took mere minutes now required hours. His legs, once swift enough to outrun any mortal, trembled with each step. The radiation had seeped into the very bedrock, poisoning the ley lines that had nourished his kind since before humans first set foot on Irish soil. He passed the remains of farmhouses, their stones scattered like broken teeth. Fields where cattle once grazed lay barren, the soil crusted and lifeless. Occasionally, he encountered the bleached bones of those who had not found shelter, grim markers on his pilgrimage through devastation. Enniscorthy appeared on the horizon, a jagged silhouette against the sickly sky. The town where Helen had lived, where her son Thomas had grown into a monster, where countless generations had been born and died while he watched from his woodland sanctuary. When he finally reached the outskirts of what had once been Enniscorthy, The devastation took his breath away. The town was a blackened mound of ruin. Though spared direct impact, firestorms that swept through the after the bombs fell on Dublin, Belfast, Cork, and Wexford. Buildings that had stood for centuries were reduced to hollow shells, their windows gaping like empty eye sockets, their roofs collapsed inward. The leprechaun moved through streets littered with the detritus of civilization's end. Rusted vehicles, their paint blistered and peeled, shop windows shattered, their contents long since looted, and everywhere bones scattered by scavengers, bleached by unfiltered sunlight, silent witnesses to humanity's folly. The church where Helen had once prayed stood partially intact. Its spire collapsed, but its walls still defiant. He paused before it, reflecting on the pointlessness of its structure and the inaction of the God it represented. "Your God did not save you," he murmured, "as mine all abandon us to this fate." Finding no signs of life in the town, he turned back south towards Brownswood. The journey was arduous, each step draining his dwindling strength. The radiation had affected him differently than humans, slower, more insidious, corrupting the ancient magic that sustained him rather than destroying his physical form outright. He followed what remained of the road, occasionally stopping to rest against tumbled stone walls, half buried in ash and ice. The countryside showed faint signs of recovery, sparse patches of hardy grass pushing through the gray soil, insects buzzing in the stillness, a thin lone fox watching warily from a distance. Nature was resilient, even after mankind's worst, but the old magic was fading, and with it, his kind. He was the last. He knew this with certainty. Across Ireland, across the world, the Fae had withdrawn into their mounds and hidden spaces as the bombs fell, and none had emerged. Their voices he would normally have heard gently chattering in his mind were silent as the grave. As twilight approached, his weary steps brought him to a sign that kindled a faint hope. The cottage appeared as the sickly sun began to set. A small stone structure nestled against a hillside, its slate roof partially collapsed and repaired with sheets of corrugated sheet tied together with twisted wire, but its walls intact. A thin wisp of tired smoke rose from the chimney, the first sign of human presence he had encountered. He approached cautiously, his senses, though diminished, alert for danger. The cottage door hung askew on leather hinges, and through the gap he could see movement within. A figure hunched by a small fire, stirring something in a dented pot. The leprechaun paused at the threshold, ancient courtesy preventing him from entering uninvited. He knocked once on the wooden frame, the sound startlingly loud in the stillness. The figure inside then reached for something, a weapon, no doubt. "Who's there?" called a male voice, young but roughened by hardship. "A traveler," the leprechaun replied, his voice barely above a whisper, "seeking shelter for the night." The man who emerged from the shadows moved with the caution of prey, tall and gaunt, with the wiry strength of one who had survived on too little for too long. His face was partially obscured by a makeshift mask of cloth, his eyes hidden behind dark goggles fashioned from scavenged materials. "You're alone?" the man asked, a crude spear held ready in his hands. "I am the last of my kind," the leprechaun replied truthfully. The man studied him for a long moment, then lowered his weapon slightly. "You don't look too sick. No radiation burns, I can see." "I suffer differently," the leprechaun said. After another moment's hesitation, the man stepped back. "Come in, then. Not much point in caution anymore. I'm Sean." "Sean," the leprechaun repeated, tasting the name. A good Irish name, ancient in its way. "You may call me Findara, Finn, if it pleases you." The interior of the cottage was sparse but orderly. Sean had created a living space from salvaged materials, furniture repaired with wire and twine, walls patched with metal sheets, windows covered with translucent plastic that filtered the harmful light. "Sit," Sean offered, gesturing to a chair by the small fire. "I don't have much, but I can share." The leprechaun sat, his tall frame awkward in the human-sized chair. He watched as Sean ladled a thin stew into two mismatched bowls. The food was simple. Some root vegetables, what might have been rabbit meat, and herbs that had somehow survived. "This is your last food," the leprechaun observed. Sean shrugged. "I'll find more. Always do." He pushed a bowl toward his visitor. "Eat. You look like you need it more than me." The leprechaun accepted the offering, understanding its significance. In the old days, to share food with the Fae created a bond, an obligation. Even now, with the old ways dying, the gesture held power. As they ate, Sean removed his goggles, revealing eyes clouded with cataracts, the result of exposure to unfiltered ultraviolet radiation. Though barely 30, hardship had aged him beyond his years. "I was 15 when it happened," Sean began without prompting. "In school, an ordinary day. Then the lights brighter than anything. We thought it was the end of the world, which in all the ways that mattered, it was." The leprechaun listened as Sean recounted the fall of civilization, the initial panic, the government radio broadcasts that grew increasingly desperate before ceasing altogether, the mass exodus from the towns that survived, the violence that followed as food grew scarcer and the sun hid behind a freezing gray fog. "Dublin, Cork, Wexford, and Belfast were hit directly," Sean continued. "But it was what came after that killed most people. The fires, followed by nuclear winter. Crops failed, livestock died. People turned on each other and took to eating corpses of anything." He described years of darkness and cold, ash blocking the sun, temperatures plummeting, everlasting winter, communities formed and fractured, disease that spread through weakened populations. The strong preyed on the weak until they too succumbed. "My father lasted 10 years, taught me everything he knew about surviving. My mother died earlier from cancer, probably from the radiation. I've been here alone for 5 years now." "Your great-grandmother," the leprechaun said carefully. "What was her name?" "Great-Granny Helen, Helen Colfer." The name sent a ripple through the leprechaun's weakened form. He sniffed and tilted his head to one side. "I smell her in you," he said, more statement than question. Sean looked up, surprised. "Great Granny Helen. Never knew her, though. Dad said she died when his dad was born. He was always telling stories about her, left from the diaries she had religiously filled in every day. How could you know that?" The leprechaun studied Sean's features, seeing now the echoes of Helen in the shape of his jaw, the set of his shoulders. The bloodline had continued despite everything, despite Thomas's darkness, despite the end of the world. "I knew your family," he said simply, "long ago." Sean leaned forward, squinting through damaged eyes. You can't be that old. Unless, his hand tightened on his spear. "What are you?" "I am AOC," the leprechaun said, allowing his glamour to fade slightly. His features sharpened, became more angular, less human. His eyes flickered briefly with their old bog water light. "What your people once called leprechaun, though that name never captured what we truly were." Sean's breath caught. "The stories. My great-grandmother left stories about something in Ravensdale Woods, about a bargain she made." "Helen," the leprechaun confirmed. "She promised to visit me, to keep me company in my solitude. When she broke that promise, I took half her life as payment. She died giving birth to your grandfather." Sean's face hardened. "And my grandfather? My dad said he disappeared. He came to the woods one night with darkness in his heart. My children took what remained of his life force." "Your children?" Sean's voice was barely audible. "Half human, half fae, born of broken promises and collected debts. They sleep within me now, what little remains of them." The leprechaun's voice grew softer, almost tender when speaking of his children. "Why are you here?" Sean asked after a long silence. "Have you come to collect another debt?" The leprechaun shook his head slowly. "I have come to pay one." He explained how the nuclear devastation had poisoned the ancient magic, how the Fae were bound to the land in ways humans could never understand. As the earth sickened, so did they. One by one, they had faded, their very essence bleeding into the wounded earth. "I absorbed my children to survive longer," he admitted. "A selfish act, perhaps, but I sensed something. A purpose not yet fulfilled." He reached across the table, his long fingers hovering near Sean's face. "May I?" After a moment's hesitation, Sean nodded. The leprechaun's touch was gentle as he traced the contours of Sean's damaged eyes. "The radiation has taken much from you. Your sight fades. Soon you will be blind." "I know," Sean whispered. "You showed kindness to a stranger, shared your last food. Such actions once had meaning in the old world. Perhaps they will have meaning in the new one as well." For a moment, the leprechaun hesitated. This final act would end thousands of years of existence, the last of his kind surrendering what remained of ancient magic to a human. Yet in Sean's damaged eyes, he saw something that reminded him of Helen. Not her betrayal, but her initial compassion, her willingness to see him as more than a monster. Perhaps this was why he had survived when all others had faded, this final chance at redemption. The leprechaun placed both hands on Sean's face, palms covering the clouded eyes. "What remains of my life force I give freely. The last magic of the O.C. passed to the bloodline of Helen Colfer." Light bloomed between his palms and Sean's face, not the sickly yellow of the irradiated sky, but the deep verdant green of ancient forests. Sean gasped, his body arching as the magic flowed into him. The leprechaun felt himself diminishing, the thousands of centuries of his existence unraveling like old rugs. The children within him stirred one last time, their voices rising in a final chorus before fading into silence. When he removed his hands, Sean blinked in wonder, his eyes clear and bright. "I can see," he whispered, "everything so vivid." Leprechaun smiled, his form already growing transparent. "The gift carries responsibility. You will father children. They will rebuild. They will remember." "You're dying," Sean realized, reaching out to touch the leprechaun's fading form. "Returning to the earth," the leprechaun corrected, "as all things must." His voice was growing fainter, his tall frame slumping as the magic that had sustained him for millennia ebbed away. "I have one request, Sean Colfer." "Anything," Sean promised. "Scatter what remains of me in the field beside this cottage, but upon the surface, where the sun's light may reach." Sean nodded, tears streaming from his newly healed eyes. "I will." "The fates have decided," the leprechaun whispered. "The circle closes. Mayhap the old magic will return. Mayhap it won't." His form shimmered once more, then collapsed inward like autumn leaves caught in a sudden gust. Where he had sat remained only a long heap of earth, rich and dark and fragrant with possibilities. 1 year later, as the brightening skies gently warmed the summer land, Sean stood at the edge of the orchard that had sprung from the field where he had spread the leprechaun's remains. Trees heavy with fruit stretched in neat rows, apple, pear, plum, and others he couldn't name, varieties that had been thought lost forever. The soil here remained fertile, despite the radiation that still poisoned much of the land. Birds nested in the branches. Fat bees hummed among the blossoms that somehow bloomed regardless of season. At the center of the orchard stood a single oak sapling, its leaves an impossible shade of green. Sean had found just over 1,000 survivors in the years that followed. They were drawn to the miraculous grove like moths to flame. A community formed around Sean's cottage, growing stronger with every passing season. They built traditional white-limed, mud-walled, thatched-roof cottages. They called the place New Ravenswood, though none but Sean knew the significance of the name. The survivors brought what skills they had, farming, medicine, crafting, and slowly a semblance of civilization returned. Children born after the devastation showed unusual resilience to the lingering radiation. Their eyes clear and bright like Sean's had become. Some whispered that the orchard's fruit had healing properties, though Sean kept the true source of this miracle to himself. Sometimes in the quiet hours before dawn, Sean would take his stick and painfully shuffle to the old oak tree in the middle of the orchard and place his liver-spotted hand against its trunk. He could almost feel a heartbeat there, a rhythm ancient and patient. "The circle comes," he would whisper, and the leaves would rustle in response, though no wind stiffened the air. Gently stroking the bark, Sean closed his eyes and listened to the sweet bird song from the surrounding orchard. "A man's worth is no greater than their ambitions, and your sacrifice gave me the purpose to dream beyond just surviving day to day and to grow a community with hope and love at its heart." Sean's old and cracked lips kissed the bark, and he murmured a quiet thank you for the last gift of the AOC. Not an ending, but a new beginning, another chance to put things right and live in harmony with the earth. And maybe one day its fairy folk, should they ever return. The next story is called Young Love Interrupted, written by Tori Routsong. Quite a bit different from the first story. Wilbur smoothed down the hair he had left as best he could. He stooped, hurting his back, and checked his teeth in the reflection of the doorknob. Maybe it hadn't been the brightest decision to subsist on coffee for the last 50 years. No matter, he was here now. The machine worked. He was here, and Terry was somewhere behind that door. Wilbur steeled his nerves. Somehow this was more terrifying than stealing all that palladium had been. It made sense, he supposed, after all. This would be their first date in half a century. Well, his and Terry's. He'd hoped the Wilbur from this universe had been a gentleman. He'd had plenty of time while wielding and programming the machine to imagine what their lives would have been like if his version of Terry had made it to 24. He would have proposed on her birthday. The ring would have been a sensible but classic diamond in a sweetheart cut. The wedding would have been small in order to save for their Italianate house close to his work. He would have gone to work and come home to a pot roast and a medium to large sized dog, and Terry, his sweet Terry, with her copper red hair and freckles like stars. Wilbur pulled her photo out of his billfold and smoothed out the creases. She stared back at him, young and bright. He did briefly wonder how this version of Wilbur would take it. He'd never been a jealous man, or rather he didn't think he would have been, if he would have had anyone. And surely this Wilbur would see reason. He would understand why Wilbur had to do this. Wilbur shook his head. He was procrastinating. His life's work had culminated all in this moment, standing in front of an ugly salt box home. Before he could think it too far, Wilbur rapped 3 times on the door and then sat and stewed in the silence, his throat thrumming with his own heartbeat. Finally, the door swung open, and Wilbur's knees almost gave out. There she was. Time had changed her, of course. Her hair wasn't copper so much as a clearly dyed bronze that Wilbur found quite ugly. Her face was worn and lined, her lips thinner than he remembered. No matter, those were cosmetics. These could be filled and fixed. What mattered was that Terry was here. She was whole. She was alive. Terry, he breathed before he noticed her thin lips pull into a sneer. Go to hell, she said before slamming the door. Finding the version of himself that lived in this universe wasn't hard, just took a bit of calibration. This version of Wilbur Beta, he decided, was posted up in a pub, either because of the whiskey or because interdimensional travel was something every Wilbur assumed he would be capable of. Wilbur Beta didn't seem too surprised to see Wilbur. His eyebrows did shoot up. However, when Wilbur told him he had been to see Terry, "You saw Teresa? I'm surprised she talked to you." "She didn't," Wilbur admitted. "She slammed the door in my face." Wilbur Beta laughed hoarsely until he coughed. "Yeah, that sounds about right. She's not my biggest fan." "Are you kidding?" The bartender, who Wilbur hadn't realized was listening, leaning over the counter. "She hates your guts." "Why?" Inside his pocket, Wilbur rubbed his thumb over his billfold. "What went wrong?" Wilbur Beta sighed. "My fault, really. We'd been married a few years. We got older. She let herself go, as I'm sure you saw. I guess I just got bored. I slipped up. Teresa found out, and, well, you see how she feels about me now. Wilbur pursed his lips. It was highly unlikely that this Terry would ever care about him, given what she'd been through. He'd have better luck with another Terry. Terry Gamma, whose lips were plumper but had let her hair naturally turn white, was surprised but amicable upon answering the door. Wilbur, you've... Well, I suppose it's been a long time. What brings you all the way up here? Wilbur frowned. What do you mean? I thought that you and Jennifer... Terry Gamma cut off as an indistinct voice called something from inside the house. It's Wilbur Bennett, she called back. Remember my old boyfriend from high school? A short, pot-bellied man with a shock of gray hair appeared at Terry Gamma's side, putting his arm around her waist. Glad to meet you, friend. Last I heard, you and the missus moved down to Florida. Wilbur's nose wrinkled. Terry Gamma was clearly disloyal to him. A true Terry, his Terry, would never have shacked up with someone else. Without saying goodbye, Wilbur spun on his heels back to his machine. The young woman who opened the door at Terry Etta's modest house immediately started crying when she saw Wilbur. You came back. I did? She reached out and snatched Wilbur's hand. She's been asking for you, you know. You're one of the only things she clearly remembers. I'm so glad you decided to see reason. Without asking, the woman dragged Wilbur through the musty house without closing the front door. The walls were sparsely decorated with photographs, each clearly labeled in bright pink post-it notes that stood out vibrantly against the hideous pink florals of the wallpaper. If Wilbur had lived here for very long, he definitely would have torn that up immediately. Finally, the woman stopped, Wilbur almost running into her back. She darted immediately to the side of the woman in the semi-reclined twin bed in the center of the room, who Wilbur realized with a growing horror was Terry Etta. She turned slowly, the right side of her face numb and blank, while the left side broke into a big smile. Wilbur took a step back. Will, Terry Etta said, lurching up and forward in her bed. The young woman helped her into a sitting position. I knew you'd come back. My love, oh my love, now we can... Wilbur had already dashed back down the hallway and out the open door. By the time Wilbur arrived at Terry Kappa's door, his hopes were already low. Still, though, on paper, Terry Kappa seemed perfect. He'd conferred with Wilbur Kappa briefly before he'd come to make sure there weren't any weird circumstances that could keep them apart. And when Terry Kappa opened the door, she looked confused, not angry. She even invited him in and gave him a cup of tea before sitting down across the table from him with her own. So let me get this straight, Terry Kappa said, idly stirring her tea with a spoon. Her veined, pale hands held a slight tremor. Wilbur tried not to notice. You're from another dimension where I died young and we never got a chance to be together. That about sums it up. Wilbur looked around the kitchen. It was rather ugly, over-adorned with posters and accoutrement. On the wall was a photograph of Terry holding a fat ginger cat. He hoped that was an old picture and there wasn't a cat around here. Well, I mean, I'm shocked to be sure, but honestly, I shouldn't be. You always were so very clever. Terry Kappa smiled warmly. Her teeth were slightly stained, most likely by coffee. Wilbur took a sip of his tea. So why did you and the Wilbur from this universe break up? He was sparse on the details. Terry Cap sighed. We just grew apart, I guess. We wanted different things in life, and Will, my Will, decided that he wanted grander things than little old me. She reached out and grabbed Wilbur's hand with her own. But you should know that I never stopped loving him. And now there's you, and you crossed dimensions to find me again. And, I don't know, I thought that I was too old to find new love. But this is old love, isn't it? You and I. Her tired, wrinkled eyes met Wilbur's, and he tried to smile back. He was distracted, though, by the bottle of sriracha on the counter. Terry hated spicy food. Next to it was a bottle of multivitamins. Terry had believed vitamins were a scam by the government. He looked back at the woman in front of him and her faded, brittle hair and her pale skin marred by liver spots, not freckles, and instinctively he recoiled. This Terry wasn't right, either. His Terry had been proud of her hair, had tanned meticulously. His Terry would never have let herself become this. "I'm sorry," he told her when Terry Kappa's brows furrowed, although, as he strode towards the door, it was her fault. He didn't look back. Wilbur took the beer from the tray and patted Terry New's hand in thanks. She smiled, her copper red hair bouncing as she turned back towards the fridge. "Anything else I can get you?" Wilbur frowned. His voice still wasn't quite right. He couldn't model it after anything but his memory, which had, after all, faded a bit after 50 years. Maybe he'd take her larynx modulator out after all. "No, that's okay, dear." Terry New grabbed a sugar-free juice for herself and flounced back to Wilbur's side. "So, what are you working on now?" She put her head down on her hands, watching Wilbur with shining eyes, her freckles like stars. "Just tinkering around," he replied, "kind of between projects at the moment." "Well, I'm sure anything you make will be out of sight," she said, smiling brilliantly. "Thank you, dear." Wilbur kept tinkering, taking breaks to sip his beer. Terry New brought him another one when it was done and stayed by his side, offering praise and encouragement for his inventions, just like she used to. Everything was just as it used to be. And Wilbur should have been elated that the love of his life was back and she was perfect. Everything was perfect. Wilbur took another sip and patted Terry New's perfect hand. She'd inevitably follow him to bed in an hour, just like she used to, just like he'd programmed her to do. She was just right. Wilbur lay next to her later that night, and felt nothing at all. Story number 3. The Looping Stranger by Chanel Fortney. Looking in the mirror, I gave myself one last look. Trying to hide the exhaustion in my face, hair swirled in a messy bun, using an excessive amount of concealer to hide the darkness beneath my eyes. A little eyeshadow, 2 coats of mascara, just enough to fake brightness in my face. I wear the usual baggy mom jeans and required company policy black shirt. All I need is my apron, which is probably crumpled on the floor of my truck. Late-night training, early morning shifts, the double life of a college student, athlete, and barista. Driving over to the cafe feels slower than usual, as if everyone is moving in slow motion. The bell dings as I push the door open. Co-workers greet me. Customers turn to look when I spot him in the corner. And he glances up from a newspaper. Who even reads a newspaper these days? He wears a dark suit that seems out of place. The fabric has a tiny shimmer in the light, as if it has a life of its own. We often see business types, lawyers in particular, with their laptops in one corner, but something about him stands out. His eyes track me as I make my way behind the counter. Rising from the table, he moves as if gliding toward me. Medium black coffee, 2 sugars. His voice is eerily smooth, like velvet. I can't shake the feeling that something is off. Slowly placing the cup of coffee on the counter, he reaches inside his coat pocket. "Thanks. Keep the change," he says. Before I can say a word, he turns and walks out. It's a typical busy shift. Crowds coming in and out in waves, orders stacking like small tidal pulls. In slow times, we wipe tables or goof off. But a heaviness stays with me no matter how hard I try to laugh it off. It's hanging in the air, a dark cloud that follows me. Back at my dorm, I peel off my jeans and stand under the hot water, trying to wash the feeling down the drain. Lying in bed, drifting, I hear distant voices and the steady electronic beeping, and then a whisper. "Wake up." I shoot up. The room is empty and the TV is off. Maybe I was half dreaming. Waking up the next morning, I shuffle to the bathroom. Something isn't right. My jeans aren't on the floor, and I could have sworn I brought my apron in this time. Maybe I was so exhausted I imagined it. Same routine as yesterday. I drink coffee from home, sit at my desk, and try to push through schoolwork before my shift. Time gets away from me, and I'm back in the bathroom, checking myself before work. My apron is on the floor of my truck, but something just isn't right. The drive to the cafe drags, slow as ever. The cafe bell dings sharp this time, like a blade. It sounds louder, as if the room goes quiet before I step inside. Co-workers greet me, customers glance up, and then my stomach jumps. The man in the corner with his newspaper. He was here yesterday. His eyes track me as he glides to the counter while I stand frozen. Medium black coffee, 2 sugars. The smoothness of his voice puts me on edge. I move slowly, like sudden motion might trigger him, as if he were some creature stalking his prey. Placing the coffee on the counter, he says, "Thanks, keep the change." He turns and walks out. Maybe he's just a new regular. It happens all the time. My shift feels over before it even starts. My mind spirals back to the man in the suit. People become regulars all the time. Others get memorized. I know what they want before they reach the door. Does he wait for me to get here? Is he a stalker? Questions ricochet through my head as I sit alone at my dining room table. Eating a college kid meal, ramen, I make in a microwave. I decide I'm going to place my jeans on the floor in a specific spot this time and just needing proof that I'm not losing my mind. Haunted by beeps and voices as I fall into a dream, flashes of a hospital hallway, doctors rushing, faces I can't make out blurring past, some faint voice at the edge of my ears, "Wake up," growing louder until a woman's face is inches from mine and screaming the words. I jolt upright, breathless, like someone sitting on my chest. The bedroom is empty. Only the fan hums. Rushing to the bathroom, I splash water on my face and grab a towel. I look down to see that my jeans aren't where I left them. Panic sets in. Is my dorm haunted? Was that the woman telling me to wake up? Sunlight spills through the window, and I let warmth wash over me to calm my mind. Desperate to get out of the dorm and to work as soon as possible. I find my jeans, where I usually keep them, folded in a drawer, and my apron is in a ball on the floor of my truck. I hate this feeling, this hollow dread, as if something bad is about to happen. Walking into the cafe, the bell rings and I freeze in the doorway. It sounds even louder than before, but I can't move. He's there in the same corner, same newspaper, same stillness. I've been watching for days. Rushing to get behind the counter, I lean over to my coworker. How long has that man been sitting there? I ask, wondering if he's been waiting for me. She frowns. What man? That man in the suit, sitting in the corner with the newspaper, I say, panic cracking in my voice. I don't see a man in a suit. Are you all right? She looks at me with concern. Not wanting to be dropped off at the closest psych ward, I brush it off. I watch him. He doesn't just glide. He doesn't disturb a single customer. Everything is happening over and over again. It's the same thing for the third day in a row. This feels like something straight out of a comic book. I'm stuck in a nightmare, or I'm going insane. I quickly decide I'm going to change something, even if it's small. I move the sugar from one side of the counter to the other. Medium black coffee, 2 sugars. His voice sends chills down my bones. There is something dark, yet angelic about it, like a quality he uses to draw people in. Every instinct in my body screams not to trust it. He must be stuck in a loop, and somehow I'm tied to it. Testing this even further, I place an empty cup on the counter. He reaches for it as I pour straight from the carafe, my eyes flicking between his face and the cup. Coffee spills over his hand, but he doesn't flinch. No grimace, no reaction at all. My stomach falls as I look back down. There is no coffee, no spill. The sugar sits neatly where it always does, as if everything has reset. Thanks, keep the change. He turns and walks out. Screaming for him to wait, I attempt to run around the counter to chase after him, to find out what is going on. Who is he? My coworker grabs my arm. What's wrong? She asks, panic written all over her face. The man who is here, there is something wrong, and I am somehow connected, I yell. There was no man. I can show you, she shoots back. We pull up the security feed. There's nothing there. No man in the corner. When I tested him with the coffee, the cameras glitched and time seemed to skip. For a beat, it was just me yelling for him to wait. I think you need to go home and get some sleep, my coworker says, gentle and firm, as if she were taming the feral raccoon in the alley. We'll be fine here, or I will call someone in. My stomach drops. Please don't let that be the code for psych ward. Sleep drags me under deep, like an anchor dropping into the ocean's depths. The dream is dark and stronger this time. Beeps pierce louder, sharper, pounding into my skull. Fluorescent lights overhead, and I'm back in the middle of the hospital hallway. Nurses and doctors rush past, their faces blurred as if smeared out of a photo. I reach out for one, but my hand passes right through. A woman leans over me, her lips forming the exact words again and again. Wake up, wake up, wake up. Her voice grows until it's a scream that rattles my nerves. I bolt upright in my dorm bed, drenched in sweat, goosebumps all over my body, lungs clawing for air. The fan hums steadily in silence, but beneath it, I swear I can still hear the monitors beeping. I pace my dorm, knowing it's not this dorm that's haunted, but the man in the suit. I won't go back there, not until I figure this out. I call my boss and tell them I'm sick, that I need more rest, and that I will not be coming in today. Shoving a piece of toast into my mouth, I decide I'm going to go to my college library to see what I can find out about that cafe and the man in the suit. putting on shorts and a baggy T-shirt left on the floor. I grab my keys, swinging my front door open in a panic. I step through, and it's not my dorm hallway. The cafe bell rings out with a deafening sound. The sound echoes in my ears as my eyes dart from the counter to the man in the corner. I look down. I'm in my work uniform, apron tied at my waist. This time the entire cafe is frozen, staring at me with dead eyes. The only movement comes from the man in the suit and when he shakes his newspaper. The noise startles me, and I instinctively look at him. I don't want to move. What is going to happen to me? Unable to take it anymore, I shout, "What do you want from me?" My voice cracks, but he gives nothing back. Refusing silence as an answer, I step into the middle of the cafe floor. The air is thick, heavy like smoke. My pulse is hammering in my ears. He lowers the paper and folds it with care. His eyes catch mine while rising from his chair, gliding until he towers over me. "Medium black coffee, 2 sugars. The words splinter something inside me. Tears swell at the corner of my eyes. "What do you want from me?" My whisper barely carries. Silence stretches. Then, soft and deliberate, he leans in. "You aren't supposed to be here." His words hang in the air, heavy enough to crush me. The cafe wavers at the edges, tables bending like reflections in water, my knees locked to keep me standing. "Not supposed to be here." He tilts his head, studying me like a specimen. "Do you hear them?" At first only silence, then it seeps in, the faint beep, beep, beep of a machine, the muffled sobs of someone begging me to wake up. My throat closes. "You're in between," he says, voice low, almost tender. His hand brushes a table and the sugar packets scatter, then snap back into place, untouched. My head feels like it's spinning, and for a moment I see white sheets and wires, a still body on a bed. My body. I stumble back, clutching my apron. "I want to go home. I want to wake up," I choke out. His smile doesn't reach his eyes. "Then choose." He holds out a cup of black coffee, 2 sugars. The steam curls upward, but the scent is wrong, like smoke and a hint of metal clawing at my throat. "Is this man the devil? What did I do to deserve this hell?" I shake my head, backing away a few steps. "What is going to happen to me?" His smile sharpens, thin as a blade. "Choose," he repeats. "You're not telling me what is going to happen to me." "No, I won't." My voice cracks. "So be it." He lifts the cup, and the cafe snaps back into place. Customers laughing, co-workers moving as if nothing happened. The bell dings sharp. Suddenly, the weight of my apron drags heavily on my shoulders. For the first time, he looks back as he walks out the door. I look down at the newspaper left on the counter, and my chest caves. Across the top, bold and dark, one word: purgatory. Thank you for listening.